Made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handcrafts and telling their stories in North America.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. The investigation into yesterday's terrorist attacks in London is continuing. A top British law enforcement official said today there's a strong possibility of an Al-Qaeda link. A question yet to be answered, one of the questions yet to be answered, were suicide bombers involved, officials say. Bodies still haven't been recovered from one of the subway explosion sites. Suicide terrorism is our topic in this portion of the program. Our guest is a University of Chicago political scientist who is an authority on suicide terrorism, Robert Pape. He is the author of the new book, Dying to Win: The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. Professor Pape heads the Chicago Project on Suicide Terrorism, a comprehensive database of every suicide attack in the world from 1980 through the end of 2003. Over that period of time, there were 315 suicide attacks. Professor Pape says the database provides evidence that we have many misconceptions about the nature of suicide terrorism. For example, he says the widely held belief that suicide terrorism is primarily a product of Islamic fundamentalism is wrong and counterproductive. He says of the 315 attacks he studied, 301 of them have their roots in large, coherent political or military campaigns. He says suicide terrorism is mainly a response to foreign occupation. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Professor Pape, thank you so much for joining us today and giving us some of your time.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, first of all, what are your thoughts today about yesterday's attacks in London?
Well, the London attacks are just part of Al-Qaeda's strategic logic that they have been pursuing, and in fact, with increasing vigor since 9/11. Since 9/11, Al-Qaeda has carried out over 15 suicide and other terrorist attacks, killing nearly 700 people, more than all the years before 9/11 combined. Al-Qaeda, although we wish it had been weakened by our counterterrorism efforts, is now stronger today than it was before 9/11, at least according to the measure that counts. That is, their ability to kill us.
Mm. So this organization is stronger now than it was prior to September 11th.
Yes, and the pattern of their attacks also reveals a tight strategic logic. And we know this not just simply from the attacks, but in Dying to Win, I quote extensively from an Al-Qaeda strategy document, that is their own document, that they produced in September 2003 for how to deal with the United States after we went into Iraq. This is a 42-page document that was on radical Islamic websites in September 2003 that was actually found a few months later by Norwegian intelligence, and that's who gave it to us. The document goes in some detail to say that al-Qaeda should not, in the short term, attempt to attack the United States on its homeland, but instead should focus on America's allies, that is, hitting the countries who went with us, who sent military troops with us in Afghanistan and especially in Iraq. Then the document went on to analyze whether they should hit Spain, Britain, or Poland. And again, this is at the length of 42 pages. They conclude they should hit Spain in Madrid just before the March 2004 elections because, as they said, Spain could not withstand two, maximum three blows before they would pull their forces out of Iraq, and then the domino tiles, that is, the other countries, would begin to pull out as well, putting more pressure on the British. Well, when we got that document, at least as I'm told by folks in our Defense Department, we didn't know what to make of it. After, of course, the Madrid elections, we take it now quite serious. I mean, the Madrid attacks, we take it quite seriously. And, of course, given that Britain was so analyzed in such detail, it was quite clear that Britain was in the gun sights of al-Qaeda as their strategy has evolved. So the fact is, al-Qaeda has grown stronger over the last few years. The threat has not diminished. The threat is growing.
Yeah. Yesterday, also, Italy was named in a communique, I believe. And today, there is word from the Italian government that there will be a troop reduction beginning in September.
Well, I've also been interviewed, by the way, the Danes. Denmark was also named. The statement that the group released yesterday couldn't have been any clearer, and it was directly in line with the 2003 strategy document. They said that they hit Britain because of British military operations in Iraq, and then their statement yesterday went on to threaten terrorist attacks against Italy and Denmark unless those countries withdrew their forces from Iraq. It couldn't be any clearer that they have a coherent strategic logic. They're just going about implementing that logic. And it also couldn't be any clearer that their number one mobilization appeal to recruit individuals willing to die to carry out al-Qaeda's attacks against us is the presence of our foreign troops on the Arabian Peninsula and in other Muslim countries. In my book, Dying to Win, it's also the first book to collect the complete set of every al-Qaeda suicide terrorist who has actually died, those who actually killed themselves for Osama's attacks. Those were from 1995 to early 2004. They make up that's almost all al-Qaeda attacks are suicide attacks, not quite everyone, but almost everyone. And overwhelmingly, I'll have the names of 67, the nationalities of 67 of those 71, other demographic data about those 71. Overwhelmingly, they come from Sunni-majority Muslim countries where the United States has stationed tens of thousands of combat troops since 1990. That is Saudi Arabia, other states on the Arabian Peninsula, Turkey, and Afghanistan. And interestingly, with Afghanistan, only after we deployed our troops there. And very few come, in some cases not at all, from some of the largest Islamic fundamentalist countries in the world. Iran, one of the most Islamic fundamentalist countries in the world, with 70 million people, three times the population of Saudi Arabia, has never produced an al-Qaeda suicide terrorist. Sudan, a population of 21 million, just the same size as Saudi Arabia, and in fact, whose Islamic philosophy is so congenial to Osama bin Laden's beliefs, he went to live there for 3 years in the 1990s, never produced an al-Qaeda suicide terrorist. And so what you see is there's really quite a close relationship between the presence of our combat troops. I don't mean advisors. I mean combat troops with tanks, aircraft, artillery, APCs, the real thing. And Osama's ability to generate recruits, his mobilization appeal. And it just is the case that his number one mobilization appeal is not how to get a quick trip to heaven. His number one mobilization appeal is to respond to the presence of foreign combat troops on the Arabian Peninsula.
And how effective is suicide terrorism in coercing concessions from its targets.
It's more effective than we'd like to than we know, and really than we'd like to admit. Probably the most effective instance of suicide terrorism happened very early on in the early 1980s, the early 1980s was something of a watershed of suicide terrorism. You really can't find instances of the classic case of a suicide terrorist attack where an individual kills himself to kill others in Algeria in the 50s or Vietnam in the 60s. It really starts in the early 1980s where Hezbollah appears in response to Israel's invasion of Lebanon. Hezbollah came into being and they began to experiment with some suicide attacks. Well, the very fourth attack, we also sent ground troops to Lebanon, actually trying to calm the situation down, was against our Marines in Beirut, the famous suicide truck bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut. Well, as a result of that, Ronald Reagan, no pacifist, he withdrew all American forces from Lebanon, and so did the French, and virtually abandoned the country diplomatically and economically. Well, that lesson, we still have to live with the results of that lesson. That single event percolates through the rhetoric not only of Hezbollah in Lebanon, but of Hamas, Osama bin Laden's statements even in the last few years, the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. That particular event has persuaded terrorist leaders that, at least for ending foreign occupation, suicide terrorism pays.
So we need to rethink then, would you say, our strategy in Iraq?
Our current strategy, Afghanistan was a very good move. Iraq has made the conquest and invasion of Iraq has made the war on terrorism harder to win. Since suicide terrorism is mainly a response to foreign occupation, that is the threat of foreign occupation from the presence of those foreign combat troops, not Islamic fundamentalism. Using military force to conquer Muslim countries to transform their societies is only likely to increase the number of suicide terrorists coming at us. In the Persian Gulf, we should, over the next year, transfer the responsibility for the security of Iraq to the Iraqi government, including the buildup of its army. We should get out of that business, leave that to the Iraqi government, and we should begin to return to our traditional strategy for the Persian Gulf, which is offshore balancing. You see, we have a deep vital interest in the Persian Gulf, something that is being overlooked in this in the current debate, and that is access to oil. That's always been our interest in the Gulf. That's why we're there and not in Africa. And in the 1970s and 1980s, we managed to secure that interest without stationing a single combat soldier on the Arabian Peninsula. No tanks, no aircraft. Instead, we formed an alliance with Iraq and Saudi Arabia, which we can do again. We relied on aircraft carriers off the coast of the Arabian Peninsula, and naval air power is now more effective than it was 30 years ago. And we built military bases so that we could quickly deploy ground troops to the peninsula in a crisis. And the strategy called offshore balancing works splendidly against Saddam Hussein after his aggression against Kuwait in 1990, and it is offshore balancing that is, again, our best strategy for securing our interests in oil while preventing the rise of more suicide terrorists coming at us.
What are your thoughts about the stated objective of establishing democracy in the region as a strategy for stabilization?
We should, given that suicide terrorism is mainly a response to foreign occupation and not Islamic fundamentalism, or not mainly some evil ideology, the use of heavy combat troops to try to solve the problem by conquering and then democratizing countries is only likely to exacerbate the problem. I'm not saying we shouldn't use other instruments, diplomatic instruments or economic instruments, to promote democracy. Obviously, we have an interest, it's at least moderately valuable to encourage democratization around the world. But if we use heavy military force to create democracies, what we're doing is planting the very seeds, creating the oxygen, if you would, that the terrorist leaders need to grow suicide terrorists against us.
Political scientist Robert Pape is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. Professor Pape heads the Chicago Project on Suicide Terrorism, a comprehensive database of every suicide attack in the world from 1980 through the end of 2003. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm a little bit confused. I'm not saying I disagree with the caller. In fact, I think I do. What I'm trying to reconcile what the guest says about the value of suicide terrorism and what my leaders, Presidents Bush and Vice President Cheney, has said. I think they have basically said, in my estimation, that the plethora of suicide terrorism in Iraq, for example, reflects the desperation of the insurgents, and as Vice President Cheney mentioned recently, reflects that the insurgency is in, quote, its last throes, end quote. And President Bush, in his recent pep talk at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, painted the rosy picture that we're winning the battle, we will not give up, and it's better to fight the insurgents in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the Middle East, rather than to fight them on our home turf. So I read these two chief executive officers as either not telling the American people the truth or being delusional about what the reality is in the use of military force by the United States government and its effect on suicide terrorism. Could you respond to that?
You see, right after 9/11, a lot of people, including myself, jumped to the conclusion that 9/11 was caused by Islamic fundamentalism, radical ideology that hated us for no other reason than that they were radical religious Islamic fanatics.
If they hated us because of our freedom and our liberty.
That's one way to put it, but that's just another way to state the same thing, which is that it's really Islamic fundamentalism that's the root of the problem. Well, what happened is that was based on, the reason you could so easily come to that view is we had no good understanding of suicide terrorism or suicide terrorist attacks, not only in the Muslim world, but just around the world in general. We hadn't paid attention to that problem, not only in the academic world, but in the government. You might have wished we did, but the fact is we did not. And so it was easy to come to that misconception after 9/11. Well, Bush administration, I'm not really defending them. Obviously, I think you're right, they have the wrong picture, but it's helpful to understand that a lot of people had that picture right after 9/11, not just Republicans, Democrats did too. And what's happened, though, is that by collecting this really robust new information and comprehensive information, you can see the real patterns of who's coming at us and why. And these are patterns. Just a week and a half ago, I was invited to Capitol Hill, to the Senate chambers, where for an hour and a half I presented this information, the details of the book, not just the sound bites, to 15 senators and representatives, no staff. No cameras. Okay, this was Richard Lugar, that is the Senate chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Henry Waxman, one of the leaders in the House on this issue, and numerous other people. Craig Thomas, one of the most conservative senators in the Senate from Wyoming, in the same small room as Henry Waxman, one of the most liberal members of the House. We spent an hour and 15 minutes going over the patterns I found and the implications and the policies, the things that I've just explained to you here, but in much greater detail and with the actual charts and books and data. And I was really struck how in that situation, across the board, this did not become a Bush was right, Bush was wrong battle. This became, let's find out who's really trying to kill us and why. And that's not something that you could have done on September 12th, 2001, because the data didn't exist. Now we have a situation, though, where we're in Iraq, we've gone down this road, and turning this policy is going to be like turning a supertanker. But it can be done, and it should be done, because going to Iraq has made the war on terrorism harder to win. And people on a lot of parts of a lot of sides of the aisle, they really do love the country. They really do want what's best for the country. They may also have their political axes to grind, but the fact is there is something underneath that, and I saw that for real in that room just a week and a half ago. And so I really think that the best thing to do is to present the data. This is just now becoming available. It's something that really wasn't, even 2 years ago when I did the very first cut of the database, it wasn't as robust and it wasn't as full and it wasn't as deeply verified. I've had a research team of 10 people doing this. When you see the book, you'll see every attack is laid out by date, by target type. Over the weekend, there's going to be a big op-ed in the New York Times, which is going to lay out all this by date for Al-Qaeda. So they're actually going to publish charts from my book in the New York Times tomorrow morning. It's just because the data is that important to see, and I'm hoping that it really will be taken seriously by people on both sides of the aisle.
Well, just back to my original question, when you look at from the executive branch, president and the vice president, and I'm not sure where the Secretary of Defense is, and I guess the Secretary of State also seems to be a mouthpiece of the president. Are they deluding themselves? Or are they deluding the people with these rosy scenarios? Or what?
I think they're wrong. Okay, I'm not going to use those other words because they're more politically charged than they need to be. And the fact is that. There was no suicide terrorism in Iraq before we got there. Anti-American suicide terrorism has been doubling in Iraq every year that we've stationed 140,000 combat troops there. And now it's coming home to Britain. As I said, it's just part of the Al-Qaeda strategy now. And you can see that the war on terrorism is getting worse, not better. And the fact is that's the powerful point to make, and it's not true that we're just about to turn the corner. We need a more workable strategy for the Persian Gulf as a whole, not just Iraq, but for the Persian Gulf as a whole, and we should move in that direction. And yes, the president and the vice president are presenting the wrong picture. Why they present it, it doesn't matter. What matters is that it's wrong. And we need to present a better set of the facts that are actually about the threat that's actually coming at us. And we need to make policy based on those facts.
I want to thank the listener for his call. I want to go on now to another listener, also in Champaign, Line 2. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I would say I certainly agree with your conclusions that the Bush policies have made things worse, not better. I would also say, though, that there were quite a number of people who, from the very beginning, were pointing out that invading Iraq would make things worse. In fact, in many respects, I think to use a poignant, if maybe some may consider crude analogy, George Bush has sort of become Osama bin Laden's wet dream. He's done everything that bin Laden could possibly hope to help recruit more terrorists. And we're going down the wrong track. I think that when people talk about, or when the Bush administration talks about establishing democracies as a way of alleviating the problem, that it's just smoke and mirrors. I don't think that there's any evidence that they have any real interest in establishing democracy in Iraq or any other Middle Eastern state. What they really want are compliant states that will look or appear to be democracies, have what appear to be free and open elections, but what they really want is to have a government that will allow them to keep the permanent military bases that they're building there right now, 14 of them, so that they can, you know, control the oil resources in that region. I'd just like to hear what your analysis of that is.
Well, let me just add a couple of points to what you said that I think you'll find interesting. In 1996, you say that Bush has helped Osama. He's done it maybe even more than you might know, because in 1996, Osama bin Laden, he gives not just these sound bites you see on CNN, but he typically gives 30, 40, and even 50-page single-space sermons and speeches that go on for an hour and a half. In 1996, one of his speeches, which was entitled The American Occupation of the Arabian Peninsula, began with the description of the ground troops, as I said, his main mobilization appeal. But then he went on to explain, to argue what the Americans were going to do with those ground troops on the Arabian Peninsula. And he said, what they're going to do is conquer Iraq and break it into three pieces, and then they're going to do the same thing to the rest of the Arabian Peninsula. Well, that was 96. What's happened by 2003? We did conquer Iraq, just as he predicted. What happened in 2005? This summer, you probably know, there are people in Washington right now debating whether we should break Iraq into three pieces, right? That's a debate that's happening in Washington. What's happened is Iraq has fulfilled a number of Osama's predictions about the bad things that were going to happen to the communities on the Arabian Peninsula as a result of American combat troops. Now, he exaggerates. I don't mean to say that he's painted a completely fair picture or anything like that, but what makes it impressive and difficult, almost impossible to deal with rhetoric on our part, no matter how good our intentions are, is that we really have stationed 140,000 combat troops on the Arabian Peninsula. We really had 12,000 combat troops on the Arabian Peninsula on 9/11. We really started to do that in 1990. We didn't have them there in 1989. And so as he lays this case out, there's just a lot of reality there that is his main mobilization appeal, and it is the conquest of Iraq has fulfilled those predictions, and which is why you see the strength of al-Qaeda growing.
Well, I would say here's the kicker. I think if you look at the budget and what the Bush administration is actually doing, I don't think there's any true interest in getting rid of terrorism on their part. I think that's just a lot of rhetoric and a smokescreen so that they can have, the political backing to carry out a lot of things that they want to do that they can justify by having terrorism going on. So in many respects, and hopefully it's going to backfire on them, but in many respects, it serves, I think, their political interest to have a lot of terrorism so that they can get the money and the power and, people's fear to back in carrying out their true agenda.
Well, I don't really, you may be right, you may not be right about their motives. I study this quite closely, and I'll tell you, it's not that easy to figure out the motives inside the Bush administration because they're so good at keeping secrets and keeping things close hold. I mean, you have to remember, up until Dick Cheney's speech on August 26, 2002, the Bush administration was saying that they weren't going to Iraq, right? So it's very difficult to kind of read their motives. But I would just simply point out that I'm not sure it matters very much, because what matters is that the picture that we're winning the war on terrorism is just wrong, and it's demonstrably wrong, and the evidence is not what documents or thoughts are happening inside the Bush administration. It's simply the pattern of attacks by al-Qaeda and by other anti-American terrorism around the world. What the measure that counts is the ability of our enemies to kill us, to attack us, or to attack our allies. By that core measure, any way you cut it, al-Qaeda is stronger now than before 9/11. And so we really need to come to grips with that, and I think that we should have a different policy, and I think the key pressure to bring to bear is the point of the threat is growing, and this policy has made it worse. I don't know that we need to go that far and say this was their motive or that was their motive. It doesn't matter whether Bush had the best intentions in the world. You can have the best intentions of the world, and you could still run off a cliff.
Mm. How did we come to link suicide terrorism with Islamic fundamentalism?
It was very easy to do right after 9/11. Like a lot of people, I mean, the 9/11 hijackers were professing religious motives, at least on the surface, the little bits that we saw initially of their motives. And it was like a lot of people, and I studied air power for 15 years before this, so I spent a lot of time studying security affairs. Like a lot of people, right after 9/11, I reached for the Quran to try to figure out what's wrong with Islam that would lead to this. And there was such thin information about the suicide attacks and the suicide attackers, and it was just very easy to overemphasize what we saw right in front of us, the little bits of the world or the parts of the data that we saw that were just right in front of us. In technical terms, in social science, we call this sample bias, where the part of the sample that you see right in front of you just becomes so salient that you think that really is the whole universe. And it happens actually quite a bit, and it's why it's so important to either collect an entire universe or complete set of the data, or to sample it randomly from the complete set as opposed to just what's coming at you. And I'm afraid it was just all too easy to do that after 9/11. And of course, the government, and this is true of the Democrats as well, was under great pressure to respond, to do something. What are you going to do? And, you know, we need to remember that the Democratic Party did not put the brakes on the Bush administration and go into war against Iraq. There were some of us that were trying to call attention to this. After all, I'm doing this work. I'm seeing these patterns emerging. I'm just a little professor who's doesn't quite have enough data to persuade a lot of people, but I'm calling attention to the problem. But you just have to remember that in the fall of 2002, a lot of Democrats supported this policy, and I think it's at bottom because they believe that Islamic fundamentalism was the key problem. Mm. And what we need to do is show them the real data of who is coming to get us and who's not.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on a cell phone, line 4. Hi.
Good afternoon. Hey, I'd like you to, if you would, please, to cut to the chase, as it were, and pretend you have a one-page PowerPoint presentation to make to the president and his advisors on with some specific bullets, timelines, recommendations. So, what are you saying that what would you recommend, frankly, if you had 30 minutes of the president's time?
Well, I did this
to say to this.
Yeah, I did this at the Capitol, essentially. After 3 years, between now and 3 years from now, the end of the Bush administration, we should shift fully to a policy of offshore balancing, which I described earlier, which would involve not abandoning the Persian Gulf, but building new alliances, using naval air power, and maintaining military bases to secure access to the region, and withdrawing all of our combat troops from the Arabian Peninsula over that three-year period of time, maybe 4 years, if it extends out 4 years, it's not a big deal, but over a real period of time that you can see the end to. In the when I was at the in the Senate, they said, okay, well, what would you do just in the next year? And I said, well, over the next year, I would transfer the responsibility for the security of Iraq to the Iraqi government, and that would include the buildup of the Iraqi army. You see, the key problem we have right now with building the Iraqi army is not that we don't fund it. We spent $5.7 billion a year over the last 2 years to build that army. It's not that we haven't got recruits to go through the 8-week training course. We have 170,000 over the last 2 years. But at the end of the day, according to the Congressional Research Service, we only have 7,000 to 10,000 Iraqis who are reliable, not that they're competent, who are reliable, who'll stand up and fight the insurgents. At the same time, there are 20,000 insurgents we're dealing with. In other words, we're losing the race. And it's not because we're not richer. It's not because we don't have more technology. It's because we are trying to build the Iraqi army, meaning they're supposed to be guided by our officers and who have allegiance to George Bush, not their own officers who would have direct allegiance to their own government. So until we abandon this foolhardy idea that somehow we're going to build an army and then run it and control it and direct it and let the Iraqi government build its own army, we're not going to have real security in the country. So we should do that over the next year. And then somebody asked me, okay, well, what would you do in the next month? Because that's the way congressmen think. And they said, we understand that you couldn't do anything other than a symbolic action in the next month, but what would you do? And I said, look, you know that there are only three brigades in the Iraqi army that are viable to confront the insurgents. What we should do is we should transfer those three brigades to the control of the Iraqi government. Right now, we control them. We decide where they're going to go. We decide what how they're going to operate with and without our forces. We should give those three brigades to the Iraqi government to deal with. It's only three. It's not going to make a huge difference, but it's a clear signal of the direction we should head in.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, political scientist Robert Pape, author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I think this interview is a fabulous scoop on everybody in the local area. Professor,
yeah.
I agree with your research and your conclusions, and I am somewhat concerned in that you are so right. Some may see you as a sort of a threat, and you may be denied or discredited by some underhanded means, and I think it's happened to other people, especially with this incompetent in the White House. Good luck as far as it takes you. That's my only comment.
These things happen. I'm a real professor. I'm an academic. I have no aspirations to be a politician or to be involved. I'm actually can do some of my best work outside of Washington. And so the fact is, I'm just very gratified that at least so far, so many people have shown interest in the actual underlying patterns of the data. But, you know, you're right. It can easily become a political football. That's just because politics itself is a football. But what I'm going to do is I'm just going to lay out the data and let the facts speak for themselves. And so far, remember, I published this article 2 years ago, and it's actually the flagship journal in the American Political Science Review. That's the flagship journal in political science, not something that hits the commercial world, but it does hit every political scientist, or 15,000 of them in the country. And the data has held up quite well over that two-year period and now has been expanded and still is holding up extremely well. And that's the core of the whole thing, because that's what creates the patterns. And unfortunately, a lot of the predictions I've been making about how I predicted that suicide terrorism in Iraq would take off and grow. I published an op-ed in the New York Times 18 months ago saying that, and that's what's happened. I've been expecting that we would get more attacks against our allies. Now the London attacks, that looks all too right. And so those patterns are coming true, but they're just coming from the data. And we just have to keep our eyes on the actual pattern of who's coming at us.
Hmm. You say in your book, Dying to Win, we like our villains to be wild-eyed monsters. Sometimes that's the case, but sometimes you say those who commit the worst crimes turn out to be quite ordinary in every other respect. We have some misconceptions, don't we, about the profile of terrorists?
Well, in the book, I collect demographic data on 462 suicide terrorists, that is the from around the world since 1980, not those who actually kill themselves in order to kill innocent people. I don't mean those who were arrested or attempted to do it or anything. These are the ones who actually did it. And very few fit the standard profile that you hear, the depressed, lonely individual, unemployed, on the margins of society. In fact, most are socially integrated, productive members of their community. Most are middle class or working class. They're technicians, they're teachers, they're ambulance drivers, they're security guards, they're paramedics, waitresses. Very few are criminals. For most, their very first experience with violence is their very own suicide terrorist attack. And for most, they see themselves as responding to a foreign occupation, evidenced by the presence of foreign combat troops on territory they consider to be their homeland. Most are not suicidal in the ordinary sense of that term, and absent this motive to respond to a foreign occupation, most would not and do not commit suicide anyway.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line one.
Hello.
Hi.
What is the concept of winning in your title? In other words, dying to win, because it seems to me your proposition is that the people are wanting to get the military, our military, out of their country. And if that's, in a sense, the essence of what they want, what do they really win in terms of the options that they have?
Well, that is what I mean by the idea of winning. That is, they're trying to get us out. They're trying to eject foreign combat troops from their homeland or territory they prize extremely highly. I don't mean to say that they couldn't have other goals. And in fact, many terrorist groups, suicide terrorist leaders, have other goals. Hezbollah, for instance, in the Lebanese group, has not only had the goal of getting foreign forces out of Lebanon, but they also have a goal of creating an Islamic State. They have a goal of dominating Lebanese politics. Well, what's quite interesting is that they've never used suicide attack for those other goals. In fact, they hardly use terrorism for those other goals, because suicide terrorism is very much conditioned upon broad community support, broad support from the local community. You see, most suicide terrorists are walk-in volunteers, which means they're not longtime members of the organization. They hook up with recruiters who are fairly prominent in the local community, and therefore those local recruiters could be easily turned in by the local community if they so desired. And in fact, you see that. After the occupation ends, a lot of times the local community starts turning in some of these individuals who don't want to give up their terrorist aspirations. You see this on the West Bank today, actually. Now the peace is starting to break out. A number of Palestinians have suddenly been Hamas. Palestinians have turned in Hamas recruiters just in the last 6 months. Well, so what happens is that there may be terrorist leaders who would still like to use terrorism or suicide attacks for these other purposes, these other goals, call them political goals or domestic political goals. But the fact is, we haven't seen that over the last 25 years. What we've seen is that suicide terrorist groups who do succeed in ending that foreign occupation are often compelled to actually enter politics. And that's what you see with Hezbollah in Lebanon and with Hamas on the West Bank.
Hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. We have to wrap up here. Last question. We've talked a little bit about foreign policy in terms of the idea of offshore balancing as a strategy. What about domestic policy? Thoughts there?
Well, the idea that we're going to build a big brother state that's really going to watch all 300 million of us, sort of day by day, so that nobody can set off this just isn't going to work. We can build a big brother state, but it's not going to work in terms of being able to watch us closely, watch ourselves closely enough that we can actually monitor everybody inside the country. That said, it really is quite important to secure our borders, and it's because of as long as American combat forces remain on the Arabian Peninsula, the basic structural factor that's providing the mobilization appeal for al-Qaeda and other anti-American terrorist groups exists. And so we have to see that threat is growing. Well, over the last few years, we've done a fairly good job of tightening up legal immigration into the United States, and we should continue that. We should also seriously consider strengthening our defenses along the border with Mexico, not to keep out Mexicans. However, strengthening and investing in border defenses on illegal immigration makes all too much sense given the presence of our forces in the Arabian Peninsula. As long as they're there, we need to maintain, we need to invest in the border security of our country.
Mm. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's really been a pleasure. Your listeners are really quite well informed.
Robert Pape has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is an associate professor of political science at the University of Chicago, where he teaches international politics. He's also the director of the Chicago Project on Suicide Terrorism. His book, Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, is published by Random House. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. It was a very light volume day at the Chicago Board of Trade, so the fact that prices were lower, double-digit lower, in the soybeans need to be taken with a grain of salt as traders continue to watch the changing forecasts of Hurricane Dennis's path and eventual landfall, making Monday's trading session probably a very interesting day, particularly on that opening bell on the Chicago Board of Trade. And on weekly continuation charts, as we look at the front months, we do indeed see it was an up week at the Chicago Board of Trade. We'll be talking to Mike Zuzulo of Risk Management Commodities in West Lafayette, Indiana, at 2:06 on the closing market report about that and other issues impacting the market. Host Todd Gleason will be by with that report for you. Let's go ahead and look at the settlements today. July wheat, a high on the day of 332.5, a low of 328, settling 328.5, down 6.25. September, a high of 342, a low of 336.75, settling 337.25, down 6.75. December, a high of 355.5, a low of 350.5, settling 351.25, down 6. March, a high of 367, a low of 362, settling 362.5, down 6.5. And May, a high of 367.5, a low of 366, settling on the low, down 6 on the day. July corn, a high of 232, a low of 224, settling 226.25, down 7.5 on the day, but up 9.75 on the week. September, a high on the day of 238.5, a low of 233, settling 234.75, down 7. December, a high of 250, a low of 243, settling 246.25, down 6.75. March, a high of 256.75, a low of 250.75, settling 253, down 7. May, a high of 259.25, a low of 254, settling 256, down 7. The red line, July corn, a high of 261.5, a low of 258, settling 259, down 6.5. September oats, a high on the day of 174, a low of 170.25, settling 173.25, down 1.25. July beans, a high of 682, a low of 666, settling 675.5, down 16.5. But up 2 on the week. August, a high of 684, a low of 669, settling 678, down 16.5. September, a high of 688, a low of 671.5, settling 681.25, down 18.25. November, a high of 695, a low of 677, settling 688, down 19.5. January, a high of 696, a low of 680, settling 689, down 19. And March, a high of 686, a low of 673, settling 680, down 21.5. July soybean meal, a high of 213.50, a low of 208, settling 211.30, down 330. August, also down 330 on the day. The high there, 211.90, and the low, 207.50, settling at 211 even. July soybean oil, a high of 24.92, a low of 24.40, settling 24.55, down 60. And the August contract, a high of 24.99, a low of 24.40, settling 24.63, down 56 on the day. Settlement prices also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and just like the Board of Trade, mostly a down day, Celeste.
Yeah, the only plus sign I have today here on my piece of paper from the Merc, July pork bellies finished higher, everything else lower. August feeder cattle, the high today 112.75, the low 111.80, the settlement 111.97.5, that down 10. September 111.70, the high 110.90, the low. The settlement 111.02.5, that down 22.5. October feeder cattle 109.80, the high, the low 109.20, the settlement 109.60, that unchanged. August live cattle 80.57.5, the high, the low 79.20, the settlement 79.35, that down 75. October live cattle 83.75, the high 83.02.5, the low, the settlement 83.15, that down 25. July lean hogs, 68.90, the high, 68 even the low. The settlement, 68.10, that down 25. August, 68.45, the high, 66.60, the low. The settlement, 66.82.5, that down 135. October, 59.70, the high, 58.65, the low, 58.90, the settlement, that down 20. December, 56.50, the high, 55.20, the low, 55.35, the settlement, that down 35. July bellies, $60 even, the high, the low, 57.55, the settlement, 59.42.5, that was up 77.5. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is currently up 134 points at 10,437. The S&P 500 up 12 at 1210. The NASDAQ up 31 points at 2107.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carl Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
But Doris H. Cordell from Palo Alto, California writes, "Dear Dr. Science, sometimes the photographs I've taken of normal-looking people show them to have fiery red eyes. Who are these people in my photographs?"
They're Ektar beings from the negative zone. Lonely creatures who desire nothing more than to have their picture taken. Since they lack the physical density to operate a camera, they rely on you to do it for them. Like chameleons, they can approximate the outward appearance of your friends and family, but since the eyes are the windows of the soul, they can't disguise their demonic interiors. I never take pictures of people anymore. So it's been a while since I witnessed this phenomenon, but I do remember it as the proximate cause of the end of my fifth marriage to, I believe, Marcia.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. To purchase the Duck's Breath 30th Anniversary Show on DVD featuring Dr. Science, Randy of the Redwoods, Ian Scholes, and other classic characters, visit drscience.com or call 800-989-DUCK.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. You'll find us on the World Wide Web at will.uiuc.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn, our technical director today, Henry Frayne, the producer for the Afternoon Magazine, Harriet Williamson. Coming up today on Odyssey, following the news from NPR at 3 o'clock, the hero of War of the Worlds is a deadbeat dad with two unruly kids, played by a star in Full Meltdown, who's fending off an attack by alien tripod fighting machines.